I wake up and there's a spider crawling across my tummy. Its front four legs are stuck straight out and are feeling their way across. It tickles. I freeze. I don't want to wake up my little sister by screaming or thrashing about in panics. It's her room. I'm just visiting from boarding school. I'm 13. I freeze because of all the other spiders, the poisonous ones. The Australian ones my dad caught when I was 8. He put them in jam jars preserved in formaldehyde so we could look at them and learn their markings. The funnel web spider, the mouse spider, the trapdoor spider, the redback spider. This is an ordinary African house spider. I let it crawl onto the bedsheet, grab a glass and a postcard from my gran. I put the glass on top of it and I slide the card underneath. I threw it out of the open window and I realise I haven't been breathing. I've never seen anything like I'm seeing now. It's all-encompassing. I've seen thunder and lightning. I've been caught in tropical downpours, but this is everything times 1,000. The electric current in the air makes the hairs on my arm stand on end. It's coming towards me. The sky is carved into sections by diagonal yellow lines that split and split again. I can smell it coming. I can feel it on my skin. When it comes, I stop breathing for a few seconds to take in the density of all the elements descending on me at once. I'm exhilarated. I feel small. The rain arrives suddenly and is suddenly gone again. Steam is rising from the hot tarmac and the stones around the swimming pool. My sister and I want to stay in the water, swimming in the rain, water, water everywhere, and we are mermaids. But Dad won't let us. The electricity is too dangerous. So we're standing under the bougainvillea, half in, half outside, dripping wet and desperate to run out but not daring. Dad is a scientist. He knows things.
We said goodbye to all the family at Glasgow Airport and I flew in an aircraft the first time. And we sat there, you know, with New Horizons in front of us and didn't feel distressed at all. The only thing that bothered me about that first flight to London was in this propeller-driven BEA Viscount, I think it was, and it had oil running along one of the engine cowlings. And I thought to myself, I don't think that should be. Anyway, we got to London fine, and then our plane was delayed.
It's the 6th of September 1970. My mum and dad are flying for the first time in their lives. It won't be the last time. Everything is new, exciting, strange. My dad is 22, my mum has just turned 23. They're newlyweds, but this is not their honeymoon. They're emigrating. So, Dad, why was your plane delayed?
Because that day in September was the day that Leila Khaled, the Palestinian terrorist who had hijacked a Pan Am plane, was shot on the plane. And so flights were delayed out of Heathrow.
The 6th of September 1970 is Skyjack Sunday. This is the day that the PFLP, the People's Front for the Liberation of Palestine, succeed in bringing the situation of the Palestinians to the attention of the world. They aim to hijack 4 planes and take them to Revolution Airstrip in the Jordanian desert. 2 planes land in Jordan. The 3rd plane is blown up at Cairo Airport. Leila Khaled boards the 4th plane, El Al Flight 219 in Amsterdam, with Nicaraguan-American Patrick Arguello. She has 2 hand grenades hidden in her bra, and he has a pistol. The hijack fails. But Leila Khaled doesn't die. It's Patrick Arguello who's shot and killed. After an emergency landing at Heathrow Airport, Leila Khaled is handed over to the British authorities. A fifth plane, Pan Am Flight 93, is then hijacked and taken to Jordan. The PFLP issue a new demand.
Our demands and conditions are very clear, and we will not go back on them, no matter what happens. These conditions are the release of Comrade Leila Khalid and the martyr's body, and their arrival to a safe place in exchange for the British hostages.
There are 310 people on the planes, most of whom are released immediately, but 40 Israeli, American, and British citizens are held hostage. The PFLP eventually blow up the empty planes. No one is killed. One man does wet himself. The situation in Jordan is tense. The Americans are ready to bomb the airfield. The British make an unprecedented move and agree to release Leila Khaled in exchange for the hostages. Leila Khaled is 26, and this is not the first plane she has hijacked. Her face is hanging on wanted posters in every major airport, and she undergoes facial reconstruction surgery between the last hijacking and this one. To my dad, she's clearly a terrorist. Well, to many people, she's clearly a terrorist, but to the Palestinians, she's a hero. Leila Khaled and my father are roughly the same age. And the day that my father flies on a plane for the first time in his life is the same day the Palestinians become visible on the world stage by hijacking passenger planes. I mean, they might potentially cross paths at Heathrow Airport on this day in 1970.
But somehow all these things you didn't know much about it, of course, at the time. And really, we were just two people newly married going on a great adventure. And so we flew South African Airways to Isle de Sol, and the plane had to stop to refuel. They couldn't fly all the way at that time because South African Airways went around the bulge of Africa. Anyway, we got to Johannesburg, we got to a hotel, and I started work as an exploration geologist. As the luck of the alphabet meant, we were sent to Pietersburg, and it was a copper, nickel, arsenic, antimony prospect. Memories, imagination, I can reimagine you beneath brown bats with moon. So this was your first job. Why South Africa? The choice of the job, the choice of the contract was all geared to what I could do and be married and live a reasonable married life. Because I had opportunities to go to Canada, I had opportunity to go to Botswana, I had opportunity to go to Zambia, and I chose the one in South Africa because it was, I didn't know exactly what it was involved, but it was sold to me as being around about mining or with facilities provided so that you would have a decent family life. Whereas the work in Canada and the work in Botswana were for single men. And if you had a wife left in the town, well, a fair number of new people who would try that, they didn't stay married long.
So I could have been born in Canada. I could have been a Canadian.
You've got to make choices, and I made choices that were to do with married life, and, well, I'm content that that was right.
My dad grows up in a windy Scottish mining village in the 1950s. He meets my mum at school. He's 16, she's 17. He's from the countryside, she's from the town. At the age of 21, he has a plan. Wife? Check. Job? Check. Children? Well, that'll come soon. Now it's 1970 and we're in South Africa.
So you're able to live well. But of course there was a distortion for someone of European descent. Because apartheid meant that some of the difficult things were kept away from you. And so my conscience did get pricked by that, but you could easily live in your own bubble, which wasn't just for the same for anyone who wasn't in the same situation.
How aware of the apartheid system were you, Dad?
Oh, you could not... you could not be not aware. You'd see the metal cage pickup trucks going around the town at night and picking up people, the papers checked, and if they didn't have their pass, they were bundled off and taken away. It was quite strictly run. And of course, you go into a post office, there were three different sections. Go into the bank, the teller would be dealing with three different queues with sight barriers, so you couldn't see who was beside you. But the teller would see them all, and of course, he would look after the white queue before anyone else. So there was discrimination was built in. It was definitely built in. Yeah.
My dad starts his career at the age of 22 as a field geologist for big American, Canadian, and finally British corporations. He is responsible for going out into the bush and bore logging an area and then deciding if it's worth opening a mine. The profit of his labour does not stay in Africa. My dad is in charge of a huge number of black migrant labourers. He literally pays them peanuts and meat and mealy meal. My parents have servants who clean their house, cook their food, and look after their children. I'm their only child at this point. They sit on benches in parks marked Europeans only and take photos. I'm the firstborn, so I'm raised by trial and error and Dr. Spock's baby book. My dad tells me I'm an observant child. I mean, I had to be. People don't talk to children in 1975.
When John came along, and Grace was looking after you, and I'm driving the car to go to the hospital to bring Mum and John home.
Grace Twala is our black maid, but I don't remember her. John is my brother.
And we stopped at the toy shop to get the doll that we'd ordered. And you said, "Oh, you're going to get my baby now, are you?" And I thought, she's smarter than I thought.
I have my dad's hair, his curls, but not his bald spot. I have a sense of humour. Can always make me laugh. I'm born in Swaziland and live in South Africa under the apartheid regime. When I'm four, we move home to Scotland and then south to London. My sister is born in England. At the age of seven, we move to Australia, and age nine, we're back in the UK. My parents move countries so often, by the time I'm 13, I've gone to seven different schools. In 1986, the whole world has its eyes on South Africa. The boycott campaign is gaining ground, and people inside and outside the country are vocally demanding an end to apartheid. My parents moved back to Johannesburg.
Oh, it was so different. I was astounded. It was formally apartheid, but the reality wasn't anything like the same. And going into a shop, you actually had supervisors of different races in things like the CNA, the paper shop, and in clothes shops and so on. People were getting jobs on merit, not on race. People were owning cars that were good cars, not just, you know, junk for the black ones and bad, good ones for the white. No, it was changing in a positive way. But there were tensions, there were problems, there were troubles along the Limpopo-Botswana border and, of course, in Zimbabwe.
It's true that the nationalist Afrikaner government repeals the Immorality and Mixed Marriages Act, which until then made it illegal to kiss or have sex with someone of a different race. You can no longer get 7 years hard labour and 10 lashes for this crime. But there are no changes to the laws requiring people of different races to live in specific geographical areas, the so-called homelands. Forced removals, bannings and banishments of black people continue to be used to keep troublemakers under control, and the local government in Pretoria is still investing in putting up fences between the black and the white areas in public parks.
In the last year, 4 whites and more than 700 blacks have been killed. Tonight, in a special panorama, we examine black perceptions of the changing state and hear their concerns for the future.
I could say the only change that I have seen is when you walk into the post office. There's no sign that non-whites. You just walk, go into the same entrance, like you go into the bottle store, you go the same entrance, says non-whites, the side, and the whites, that side. Even though the stations, they haven't got those signs anymore. That's the only change that I've seen so far.
Blacks have decided to fight for their rights. And they will fight for their rights to the bitter end.
Well, it's already started. South Africa is now burning.
By June of that year, there were at least 45 recorded incidents of insurgency attacks by the ANC, which is then considered a terrorist organisation. This is more than in the whole of the year before. There are riots in the townships, arson and bomb attacks on government buildings. The trade unions are organising strikes in the mines where my dad works. This resistance, or political violence, flares up everywhere. In July, the government declares a state of emergency, and in the next year, arrest more than 25,000 people, imprisoning them without trial. My brother is 11. I'm 13. We're sent back to England to go to boarding school, so we don't get indoctrinated by the apartheid regime. My sister stays. Mum and Dad say she's young enough not to be affected. I look after my brother, and we fly home every holiday as unaccompanied minors with British Airways. We wear red and white striped pouches around our necks, containing our passports and our tickets. We jump the queue at the boarding gate. At takeoff, our ears pop, and at landing, I vomit. My brother holds my sick bag. On arrival in Johannesburg, security is tight. We see soldiers patrolling with machine guns. And at the gate, my mum has dyed her hair, so I walk straight past without recognising her. We live in Johannesburg, 1,753 metres above sea level. We live in a house with a swimming pool, a high wall, electric gate, sprinklers that come on automatically, and an alarm system. We leave our house only by car. We drive to the shopping mall, to the cinema, we drive to the Pick and Pay supermarket. On the way home, we see black people sitting on the side of the road on old tyres. We see police combis, we see military vehicles. The township of Alexandra is only a stone's throw away. We do not hear about the riots on the news in South Africa because there is no free press. My brother and I, we watch the news in England at boarding school, and I see images that shock me, but I don't take in that this is just down the road from where my parents live. I mean, I know, and I don't know. My parents' friends in Johannesburg, they talk about leaving the country. They don't talk about apartheid. We're constantly warned about safety and violence. In 1987, a bomb goes off in Hillbrow near my dad's office. Does he hide under his desk with his briefcase over his head or go to a bar downtown for a drink afterwards with his colleagues? No, we don't talk about who does this or why they do it. And we still don't talk about apartheid. I'm 13. Back at boarding school in England, I get my period for the first time. I start to worry. I'm unable to sleep. I stop telling people I live in South Africa. I'm ashamed. At boarding school, my brother repeatedly packs a bag and walks out of the front gate of the school. He says he's going to South Africa. He gets into fights. He attacks a fellow student with a pair of scissors. I mean, he could get expelled. So when my parents move to the United States, they take him with them. I'm left alone in England. I'm a good girl. My mother says, I never have to worry about you. I fly back and forth across the world on my own. I smile a lot. I try to please everyone. When I visit my parents in America, I'm confused. In Cleveland, Ohio, everything seems to be decided on the basis of race. Although half the people in the city are African Americans and half European Americans, although no one ever says that because white people are just Americans, they don't mix. So they have separate suburbs, separate schools, separate meeting places, different modes of transport. The church my parents go to is less mixed race than in South Africa. Is this the land of the free? I'm 16. I wear secondhand men's clothes. I make gay friends for the first time, although none of us know this yet. We're angry. I read up on the colonial and racially segregated histories of the British ex-colonies, and I become acutely aware that I have no idea what it feels like not to be white.
When the summer rains were slow to get going, and then you would find this cloud appear in the afternoon, and a thunderhead would appear, and it would then plummet down, dropping a huge quantity of rain in half an hour. And then it would disappear, and the ground smelled different. In fact, when it was coming, you could smell the rain coming. You could feel it, and it was intense. And then when it finished, the air would warm up again, even though the sun was nearly setting. It would be just about sunset, these wonderful smells. And it was a rich sort of, I don't know, sort of fecund smell, you could almost say, you know, fertile, growing. And that was quite shocking. But I also remember the fruit. I mean, driving through the orange growing areas near Groblersdal or Potgietersrust, or you know, the areas where there was fruit grown and you could buy oranges cheaply in big bags, or lychees, you know, roadside vendors selling them. So there was a great quantity of wonderful fruit to be had, and meat you could get. Great big steaks, really quite cheaply. So you're able to live well.
I'm lucky. I can wander easily through passport and border controls, past policemen with machine guns with my British passport held high. I mean, I fly British Airways, paid for by my dad's company. I'm driven to the airport in a corporate car. I never have to deal with racism or random discrimination based on the colour of my skin or nationality. I've never stepped barefoot into an old boat at night because there's no other choice for my family. I've never been forced to flee violence or war or oppression, and yet I've migrated again and again and again. I'm lucky. I'm a white child. I've inherited the empire.